Okay, well, it's very nice being here after a long hiatus of, I don't know, almost 3 years. So, reminding myself how nice it is to be at the Perimeter Institute, you know, you should count yourselves lucky. I'm going to talk about an overview of recent work, not aimed necessarily at the super expert, but, you know, trying to have a bit in there for everyone. So, these two, in a way, represent progress between, you know, when we started thinking about doing quantum gravity non-perturbative in what is now called causal dynamic triangulation, and kind of where we've gotten recently in terms of studying observables. So, so what is my perspective on the subject of quantum gravity? So, what I really try and do is to construct it as a fundamental theory of quantum gravity, as a non-perturbative and diffeomorphism invariant quantum field theory. So no exotic ingredients, if you like, where geometry, however, is dynamical. And then study its properties in a Planckian regime. And of course, we know that this is not an easy task. It presents a large number of technical, physical, and conceptual challenges dealing with the well-known infinity, QFT infinities, the absence of a fixed background spacetime, devising appropriate numerical and renormalization methods, then of course also re-deriving classical theory in the limit as a sanity check, and of course relating things to phenomenology. So that's a big package of things to do. So are we able to do any of these things? And the message of today will be that this is really possible. So major advances towards these goals have been made in this research program of causal dynamical triangulations. And it sets, if nothing else, a concrete frame of reference beyond formal matters, you know, arguing about approaches, for what we may be reasonably expect to be able to achieve in our quest to relate, construct and relate then Planckian quantum gravity to real macroscopic observable physics. So think of it as a blueprint, if you wish. What I'm going to say. So why should you care about these things? Well, some of you are just intrinsically motivated by wanting to understand quantum gravity. So what I present to you is a definitely non-trivial approach, which has given us already unexpected results without invoking any exotic ingredients, as I have already said. So we have a functioning computational framework. So think of that as our lab. And it allows us to evaluate certain quantum observables beyond perturbation theory. And just thinking about it, advertising it as a tool, you know, CDT is to gravity what lattice QCD is to non-Abelian gauge theory. So think of it as a genuine computational tool that allows us to access a non-perturbative regime, which we currently don't seem to be able to do in any other way. Now, from the point of view of symmetries, this is, of course, very different from a gauge symmetry. We know we have to take diffeomorphism symmetry into account. And that's very, very different. And it acts differently, and it acts on spacetime itself. And my claim is that we finally understand at least one way of handling this consistently in the full quantum theory. So in the non-perturbative quantum field theoretic regime of gravity. So what is the demystification about? It's just to say, really, this way of thinking about it brings quantum gravity to the realm, if you like, of standard quantum field theory with all its standard tools and also standard ideas. But they have to be adapted to the fact that geometry is dynamical. And we know that kind of this makes all of the difference and leads, of course, to many non-trivial aspects one has to deal with. So, but other than that, quantum field theory and general relativity viewed in this way seem to be perfectly compatible. So unless what you read basically as an introductory sentence in any public article about quantum gravity, that this is maybe not the case. Okay. So here, what also turns out in this approach, which I would call a bottom-up realization of quantum gravity, is that the causal structure you're putting in is essential. You're looking at a path integral, but it's not a Euclidean path integral, but a Lorentzian one. And unitarity is also realized in this model. So that's a quite non-trivial property, of course. Now, in terms of kind of phenomenology, the kind of the closest or the most obvious route one sees coming from this approach to linking kind of to the real world will be, I believe, in kind of early universe cosmology. Yeah, so modeling things at the Planck scale and then kind of blowing them or trying to relate them to standard, if you like, currently only accessible with kind of QFT and curved spacetime models of how we describe the very early universe. So the challenge will be to link things there. But one is not doing quantum cosmology here, so there are no symmetry assumptions a priori that go into the construction. So all degrees of freedom are there, but of course you might be interested in picking out certain cosmological large-scale aspects of those and study those. Okay, but otherwise, you're just talking about a full theory of quantum gravity. So just on one slide, just to remind you of some of the, in part, commonplaces of why it's difficult to reach these goals of quantizing gravity. So, and the key one is, again, that we're not talking about a theory that's taking place on a fixed background space-time, but space-time itself is dynamical. And of course, as we know for very long, perturbatively treating the theory around a fixed, typically Minkowskian background doesn't really give you a consistent fundamental theory that would be valid on all energy scales. But it will be at best, I mean, a composition of the Lorentzian G mu nu in a kind of Minkowski plus small perturbation and doing linearized perturbation theory, I mean, only ever gets you so far, maybe in the context of an effective field theory, but not all the way to the Planck scale. And the problem then is, because the standard perturbative constructions do not work, or we have already known they don't work, then there is no single one way that everyone agrees on what one then should be doing instead, you know, going beyond perturbation theory. If you look at quantum field theory, you could say, okay, are we confronted with this type of difficulty somewhere else? And then the answer is yes, for example, in trying to understand non-perturbative properties of QCD. So can that serve as a blueprint? I will argue to some extent, yes, kind of morally speaking, but of course one has to tweak again what one means by, you know, going non-perturbative, because the symmetries are totally different here from those of the gauge theory. Yeah, and of course QCD is a fixed background, and if you're thinking, you know, of putting QCD on the lattice, well, that just is a fixed lattice that serves as your proxy of, you know, the flat Minkowskian or big rotated Minkowskian background. And this will of course have to be different in the context of gravity also. Now, what hasn't helped exactly in our making progress on quantizing gravity is of course the fact that there are no direct obvious experiments or observations available to guide the construction of the theory. So of course, quantum gravity, as many of you know, has a long and maybe torturous, occasionally, history. So I'll make it very, very short. So I would say characterized into two periods, so especially non-perturbative aspects of quantum gravity, so up to the year 2000. One is just arguing, everybody's arguing about the best approach and, you know, what quantum gravity should be if only we knew what it was about. That contrasts with the fact that, well, no one really knew kind of what interesting observables, if we had such a theory, we should compute, and how, anyway, how should we compute them, you know, beyond perturbation theory. So what I'm trying to argue is that since then, we have made genuine progress by basically, in a way, going back to good old quantum field theory. And my impression, just looking at, you know, the community also as a kind of the more string-based part of the community, is that generally one is reverting back to quantum field theoretic methods. And of course here, what we still have to do is to push them beyond perturbation theory. So, and the question is what is the way of doing this? So I would claim that we have made significant progress in now what to compute and also how to compute. And I can here, well, let me take the opportunity of advertising. This is a write-up of a set of lectures I gave on quantum gravity that touches on many subjects, but also on this one presently. So let me briefly stop to sketch to you, basically, what is this approach about? What is the logic of how one proceeds and what are the ingredients? So the logic is really that of the path integral. Yeah, so here, this is kind of the formal path integral, also called sometimes, you know, the sum over histories, for pure gravity. So I could have coupled matter, but for simplicity, let me not do it. So what I'm doing here, what I'm instructed to do, is to integrate over all states of, you know, curved spacetime, empty curved spacetimes. So each one of the elements here of what I'm integrating over in this formal path integral is a Lorentzian metric, but modulo the diffeomorphism symmetry. So I call that, this is like the space of Lorentzian geometries. So kind of the true physical degrees of freedom. Yeah, so we've gotten rid of the coordinate invariance. And then I'm instructed with some unknown measure, functional measure, to integrate all these objects. And each one I'm supposed to weigh with a complex phase factor that has some version of the gravitational action in there. Einstein-Hilbert action, this high-order curvature term, you know, you make your choice. So, so that's the object we are looking at, and that's what will define quantum dynamics for us. Okay? And the difficulty, in a way, is to make, to say precisely what one means by such an object, yeah? And then how to evaluate it and how to extract physical information. So the way we go about it has actually a long history, and which goes by the name, or initially, this is 1980s, went by the name of dynamical triangulations. And it was an approach in Euclidean signature. So instead of, you know, summing here over Lorentzian objects, one put here just Euclidean objects, I mean, Euclidean geometries, four-dimensional geometries, modular diffeomorphism, and then substitutes these complex weights by e to the minus s, with s some appropriate, you know, say Einstein action, but of, in a way, unphysical Euclidean curved spacetimes. Yeah? So, so one learned there, inspired actually by ideas coming from wanting to describe string world, the dynamics of string world sheets in a non-perturbative way. One came then to a two-dimensional, a formulation of two-dimensional quantum gravity, where the curved two-dimensional Riemannian spaces were described in terms of gluings of equilateral triangles. Right? So the rule is, in order to make a sum, kind of a Euclidean sum or integration over all two-dimensional curved spaces, approximate these spaces through gluings of equilateral triangles, each one, you know, wave is a kind of gravitational action, can you do the sum? And it turns out, in two dimensions, yeah, one can actually analytically do the sum. Yeah? And so one can, in a way, even in the continuum, you know, do this kind of path integral in 2D, the pure gravity path integral, and one can compare it to an analogous formulation which uses this approximation tool, which goes nowadays under the name of random geometry, also in those days already. So random geometry means you give me a bunch of basically identical building blocks, and I try to understand, you know, the space of all objects I can glue together from these building blocks according, say, to some manifold rules. Yeah? And each of them I give a weight that knows about the volume and maybe the curvature and maybe other properties of the space. But it's a way of talking about ensembles of geometries and their intrinsic geometric properties. So it's beautiful that this works in two dimensions. And of course, the obvious thing, you know, coming from quantum gravity is to say, hey, let's just do this in four dimensions, right? This is exactly what you're trying to understand. So what I want to say, of course, this was all invented by physicists, clearly some of them also in this room, in two dimensions. By now, this has become a big industry in mathematics, yeah, in people trying to understand ensembles of these random structures. If you're interested in this, I recommend this overview article by Scheffel to you. This links also to the story of Liouville gravity, yeah, and all the different ways one can talk about Liouville gravity, one of them being exactly as coming from doing a path integral like this. So many, many interesting things have been learned from that. One of them is that in two dimensions, if you really do this and you you take, you're always interested not in the finite triangulations, which consist of n building blocks, but you're interested in kind of the collective properties of these objects as you make them infinitely, I mean, not infinitely big, but as you refine them infinitely, let's say, okay? So you're always interested in some continuum limit as the number of your building blocks goes to infinity. Now, what one can then understand very explicitly in 2D is kind of, in that limit, a typical object is not some nice 2D, you know, smooth looking space. It's objects like that. Yeah. And well, so this is actually, and what you get in two dimensions and what is now understood in a mathematically rigorous way is that the continuum limit of ensembles of these objects give, for instance, if you fix them to be topological two spheres, something that's called the Brownian sphere as a kind of as a limiting metric space with what we would call quantum properties, but which you can see is, yeah, anyway, very non-classical things. So there are many lessons there, but one of, so Brownian, it's called the Brownian sphere. So the Brownian sphere is to two-dimensional random geometry what the Brownian motion of a path or Brownian path, right, is to random motion of, say, a particle in the background. So that's the same thing. Of course, we are doing physics, or some of us are. We are trying to do this applied to true quantum gravity. That means we have to go to four dimensions. It also, it turns out, it means that we have to somehow bring in Lorentzian signature, because the Euclidean higher dimensional generalizations of this game suffer some pathologies, which one hasn't been able to resolve. So now, how the whole ball game started was exactly in two dimensions, namely Jan Arnbjørn, who's sitting also here, and myself. We were thinking about what could be just in the toy model of 2D quantum gravity, what could be a Lorentzian analog of these Euclidean constructions. And the way, what we ended up doing were, well, substituting kind of the equilateral building blocks that enter the Euclidean story by Minkowskian building blocks. So what it turns out one has to do, well, one edge length is not quite sufficient, but you need to talk about space-like and time-like edges. But from these building blocks, you can build two-dimensional curved spaces with Lorentzian signature and put them into a path integral like this. That's a model that in 2D you can analytically solve again. And maybe somewhat surprisingly, it turns out to be distinct. So it lies in a different universality class as a toy model of quantum gravity or quantum geometry. Okay. And the huge bonus, of course, which took several years to establish, it also leads to interesting results in higher dimensions.
I have a question.
Yes.
For the gravitational action, do you include a cosmological constant?
Yes. Yes, that's always there. And indeed, in 2D, because you know the topology is always fixed, well, yeah, you don't even have a curvature term. So that's actually all there is. So in order to get here, the only weights that you're putting in is exactly just the volume part of the, if you like, of the Einstein-Hilbert action in two dimensions. Okay. In higher dimensions, of course, the curvature term is non-trivial, and you will always include at least, you know, the R term, possibly others.
And also, do you assume there is a no boundary term?
Well, these are all for, I mean, for instance, these are for no bound. These are just, you know, for spherical topology. So in general, what one is extracting by this method is just, if you like, bulk properties in a modern way of speaking. So, and one is not interested, or it's also not so easy to treat boundaries explicitly. I mean, you can come back to this question later, but it's bulk, you know, it's bulk dynamics. That's I would say the strength of being able to address it in this formalism without needing matter in there or boundaries and, yeah. So to construct observables, as you'll see. Yes.
In the Euclidean case, this is the topology of the Euclidean space-time, which is
exactly.
In the Lorentzian case, you would need no boundaries at initial.
Well, exactly. So that's correct. So in that case, the overall topology, we choose it of, if you like, well, a time interval times a spatial slice, which we take to be either an open interval or an S1. But I should say, in, you know, when we then simulate or deal with these models, often we cyclically identify the time direction. In a way, not to have to deal with boundaries. okay, or not to have to make any specific choices regarding boundary conditions. So, okay. So it's not exactly a new idea to try and put quantum gravity on the lattice. Yeah. So anyway, so what is the general idea that also underlies, of course, putting general quantum field theories on a lattice? Yeah. So the lattice is acts as a regulator of the underlying space-time. Yeah. Just think of, again, hypercubic lattices that you can use, you know, you can study quantum field theories, scalar fields, say, but most interestingly, non-abelian gauge field theories. So then the lattice, you know, you make your choice, it doesn't really matter too much. It comes with a UV cutoff, which is kind of the, you know, the distance between adjacent vertices, you know, the length of the edges. Now, and what you then do, you have to take a continuum limit, which not only implies that you're shrinking away these lattice edges to zero, but what is always needed is that the, what is called, I mean, the bare action that you're putting as weights, you know, into your lattice model, well, the bare coupling constants you're putting in there need to be renormalized in order to find an interesting continuum theory. And such the existence of such continuum theories necessitates that in the phase space of your model, thinking of that as a statistical system, you need a second or higher order phase transitions. So the question is, can a similar logic apply for gravity? And how do we deal, can this as a way of deriving non-trivial interacting quantum field theories, which is known to work, say, in QCD, can this be applied in the context of gravity? So in particular, so these lattices we are looking at, you really should think of as a regulator that you want to remove in the end. So you really want to shrink away that bit of discreteness. So we are not talking about postulating, you know, Planck scale discreteness by saying, okay, each one of my lattice edges, you know, is a Planck length long. No, that's not what we're doing. So we're getting rid of this in the process of trying to define a continuum theory. Of course, the existence of a limit is not a priori. It's not a certain thing. So you have to show that this can be achieved. Okay, now the benefit then of adopting such a kind of, you know, critical systems idea is that if such a continuum limit exists, it will be largely independent of all the arbitrary regularization choices that you put into the construction of the model. You know, why do I choose, you know, a square lattice instead of, I don't know, a random lattice or a triangulated lattice or, you know, some other building blocks, right? So most of these kind of arbitrary regularization choices should just completely drop out. You know, in when one finds when such a scaling limit exists in the vicinity of these second order transitions. Now, so already in the late 1970s, people in quantum gravity, and I should say, you know, Lee Smolin, who is at least not physically here, was actually one of the people who pushed that very early on, was to say, okay, let's try and emulate the successes of lattice QCD in gravity. Now, what's the most meaningful starting point? Well, we need a connection, right? Because what is the analog of our gauge connection? You say, okay, if I reformulate gravity in a first order formulation, then I have a connection, I have a spin connection. Yeah. So this type of first order formulation, people try to put on the lattice, trying to make things look kind of as much as possible as a lattice gauge field theory. And then kind of see, you know, what do we get when we simulate those? So this was done in, you know, in many, so you have then a tetrad, you have tetrad variables, you have spin connection variables, some kind of lattice of your choosing. And that was, people studied this for several years quite intensively, but nothing very interesting was ever found. So you can ask yourself, you know, what could we possibly have done wrong? It's a very long story, but let me cut it short. I think one obvious flaw is to ask, well, where has the diffeomorphism invariance gone? You've put the theory on the lattice, just the standard continuum variables, you know, some ad hoc, if you like, discretization. But yeah, the diffeomorphisms they've gone somewhere, but it's difficult to pinpoint where. So might that be the key of why these never produced any interesting results. I think it's a worthwhile hypothesis, especially in view of the fact that there are almost at the same time started some kind of not so naive ways, that's how I would call them with hindsight, of putting gravity on the lattice. And these were based on the beautiful idea of wedges coming totally from classical gravity and saying, okay, can we solve the Einstein equations approximately numerically, completely getting rid of anything you want to, anything to do with coordinates? Yeah? So can we kind of formulate them in the true physical degrees of freedom? And the suggestion was to do that exactly by substituting the continuum ingredients, M, smooth, I mean, differentiable manifold, and some smooth assignment of G mu nu's by other variables that are no longer dependent on coordinate choices. And these would be the edge lengths of what we call a simplicial manifold. Simplicial manifold is just a thing we glue from triangles in order to get a curved object. Yeah. So what it turns out is the relevant, what are the relevant variables? If one declares these triangular building blocks to be flat on the inside, they are completely characterized by giving the length of the edges of the triangles. And the same works in any dimension and any signature. Yeah? So then you can rewrite everything you're doing in, if you like, in classical gravity, the action, the Einstein equation, in terms of these length variables. You know, and you just make them part of some a priori chosen triangular lattice structure. So that was the idea. The beauty is that one is really working on, so diffeomorphism invariance is kind of manifest in the sense there are no coordinate labels anymore around. So it's really working directly on what I call the space of geometries. So it's really metrics modulo diffeos. What you can point to in DT and CDT is, of course, that if you put these structures, if you want to compute with them, say, also in a computer, you have to give the objects names, because otherwise you don't know, you know, what you are manipulating. So you give them names, you give them labels. But so it's very easy to kind of mod out by this redundancy that you're introducing, because the labels are, of course, totally unphysical. So you could say, well, morally speaking, this is an analog of diffeomorphism invariance, but of course, as a mathematical structure, it's something very different. But anyway, this is what one uses. So what is now the path integral? Now, according to CDT, so I told you the difficulty is to make, you know, make precise what are all the ingredients in this very formal path integral I've written down. So here I've done it for you. So here is again the very formal object I had on one of the previous slides, where one is integrating over these geometries, elements of this quotient space. And here for definiteness, I'm now choosing the Einstein-Hilbert action here. Now, what does that become in CDT? It becomes the triangulated versions, this is just the wedgie idea, where all four-dimensional curved spacetimes are glued from Minkowskian four-dimensional building blocks, which have edges, some of which are space-like and some of which are time-like. So this is a building block in four dimensions. And of course, the interior geometry is flat by definition and completely defined by these length assignments of the edges. And in particular, anywhere in the interior, you know exactly where the light cones go. Right? So this is what it means to have the geometry fixed. Now, what you then have to say is how these objects should be assembled together, glued together, in a way to generate then an ensemble of space times that you want to sum over here. So what turns out to be important is that you glue these things together in a way that preserves overall a causal structure. So I call this a discrete analog of global hyperbolicity. So the light cones have to line up kind of all, you cannot have closed time-like curves or anything. So that's what, of course, this type of building block enables you to do. That are the gluing rules. Locally, there are also manifold rules. So the objects you're gluing together, they look kind of nice locally and four-dimensional. And then the prescription is to sum over all those with some version, simplicial version of the gravitational action. Yes?
Is there a possibility that you generate higher derivative terms even though you started with a discretized version of
Excellent. That's an excellent point. So, yeah, so what appears here is what one would call the bear action. And indeed, of course, what contributes in this, you know, n equal to infinity limit is, of course, how many geometries, you know, contribute at a given value of the of this bear action. And you get to a whole contribution, if you like, from the entropy. And this combines with this bear action to, well, something we could call an effective action, and that will indeed, it will contain all higher curvature terms. So really, you know, if there is an interesting continuum limit, you know, where, well, as there seems to be, then it indeed, it's not, you cannot explain it by the bear action, but the if you like, the measure or the entropy of the contributing, the micro geometries that enter here play a very crucial role in bringing about the non-trivial effects in this non-perturbative regime one is studying on the computer. Yeah. So it, one is not making one is not unduly, you know, putting oneself on a sector where somehow these are suppressed. No. But of course, one doesn't have, if a coupling constant that one could change if one doesn't put an explicit higher order curvature term here. But then the logic is, you know, this is a minimal thing one can do. It turns out, I mean, you always need those two terms to get something interesting. Now, if we wouldn't see something interesting just with this type of bare action, you would say, okay, let me throw in a higher order curvature term together with a coupling, and let me then, you know, look through the, let me then vary that coupling and understand whether I can find now something interesting. I would say we haven't been in that situation because we already see plenty of interesting things without putting this in explicitly. So thanks for the question. So again, I'm emphasizing here, we are not interested in the finite triangulations, but always in this regularization independent continuum limits, which involve, of course, renormalization and involve exactly picking up other terms that I haven't put in explicitly in the bare action, if one can understand them in this way. So the discrete hyperbolicity and the well-definedness of the causal structure is implemented by kind of stacking layers of building blocks, which is here in illustrated in 2+1 dimensions. So where you can think of the four-dimensional geometry of consisting of a three-dimensional triangulated Euclidean signature objects that are kind of interpolated with this type of four-dimensional building blocks. Yeah. So this picture is a little bit misleading because it seems to say, you know, these layers are kind of flat and you can just pick them out of the geometries, but this is of course a complete artifact of the way I've drawn this here. Now, the beauty is that we don't have any coordinate redundancy, and although this turned out not to be a particular benefit in the old, you know, doing GR numerically a la Reggie, people have looked into this, but it turns out to be quite crucial in dealing with the diffeomorphisms in the full quantum theory. So curvature is captured, you may be familiar with this idea, by deficit angles. If I glue together, say, equilateral two-dimensional triangles, right? If I put 6 around the vertex, it is a piece of flat space. If I put 5 around the vertex, I'm picking up Gaussian curvature. And so this is a general principle in which these objects are curved in a kind of, you could say, in a discretized way. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can you say a word about the symmetry factor in the sum?
Yes, the symmetry factor. Yeah. Thanks for asking. So these are the size of the automorphism group of the underlying triangulation. So the number of non-trivial things you can map the thing onto itself. I mean, usually this is one, but in special cases, yeah, you can imagine it's non-trivial. So yeah, one can say more about these things. So, but it's a natural analog of kind of the de Witt measure in the continuum. So like where space-times with isometries are suppressed in the path integral. So this is a kind of discrete analog of this. Yeah, but it's an interesting story, but I think, yeah, there is a good logic behind understanding why this is there. And of course, for large triangulations, this is like almost always one in a very literal way. You have a comment?
Yeah, well, I should maybe add that in the computers, I mean, you are actually working with label triangulations. And what you do then is that you divide, you cannot have this 1 over C of T, which is in general impossible to calculate, although it's usually 1, but if you really want to calculate one last triangulation, you cannot calculate. But you divide by 1 over N factorial, where N are the number of vertices and the number of
labeled objects.
Yeah. But it turns out that this automatically ensures that you get this weight here if you view it as unlabeled triangulations.
So as I said, it's a long. It's natural.
In factorial, because you can calculate except when it has special symmetries, then it is less. So then there's something left over, and that's exactly the factor 1 over C.
Indeed.
So
yes. So thank you for these additional remarks. Entirely correct. Yes. So the question is now, let's get to, okay, we have now a piece of machinery, computational machinery, actually, what can we do with it? So now we get to, well, what are we looking for? Well, we have a theory with some symmetries, if you like, we inherit of geometry, and it comes with observables. Now, if you're in pure gravity, I mean, as you're familiar with, then there's nothing kind of to point to any particular, say, point in space, right? There's nothing to mark this. So the natural diffeomorphism invariant observables when you are in pure gravity are, for example, non-local integrals of scalars. So R of x is not an observable in that sense, because in your pure gravity theory, there's nothing to mark out that point x, now that being the difficulty. So however, this non-local integral is perfectly labeling, you know, diffeomorphism invariant. But it's an unfamiliar thing, because of course it's a very global thing, right? So however, so this is not a bug, but this is a feature of quantum gravity that you have to deal with and you learn how to deal with. So to really, how is are physically interesting properties, let's say of your non-perturbative piece or little quantum space, some quantum universe, how are they encoded in these types of observables? And what are interesting and what type of information do they give me, right? So we get to something I call expectation management. So typically, the favorite question you are asking about quantum gravity, coming from a very kind of semi-classical background, or thinking classically or semi-classically, will not have a good diffeomorphism implementation in terms of well-defined observables in this sense. So one has to be careful. But again, this is a feature. So that are not the most often, you know, the most natural things that are useful in understanding the quantum theory. But this is something one has to deal with. So the question is now, taking this point of view, having a bunch of observables, I'll give you some examples in a second, have we found anything new, like a quantum signature, something we didn't expect? Yes, the answer is yes. So there is a true quantum signature, and it was first seen in CDT, in four-dimensional simulations we did back in 2005, so that's an awfully long time ago. What we were studying was the spectral dimension of space-time in the full quantum theory, and this is something that characterizes the spread of a diffusion process in a very in very arbitrary spaces, and that enables you to attach a dimension to the space. If you don't know it, you set up a diffusion process, and if you let the diffusion process just run for short diffusion times, it explores microscopic properties. If you let it run for very long times, it will explore macroscopic properties of your space. So that's also a beauty. You know, you can say, okay, what happens on Plankian scales? What happens on macroscopic scales? And what we found is that on macroscopic scales, this seems to be like compatible with 4. That would be like the expected dimension of space time. But microscopically, in the vicinity of the Planck scale, it seems to go to somewhere like 2. It's a very long story. It's worthy an own talk. Many people in many approaches have looked into it. And there is even, I mean, especially Steve Gottlieb has hypothesize there might be that might be general properties of many, well, a universal property of quantum gravity, maybe in the best of all cases. You know, a little bit the non-perturbative analog of getting correctly out that S equal to A over 4 for the entropy of a black hole. Right? So like possibly a measure for, you know, the quality of your own quantum gravity theory. Okay. So that's the suggestion. However, of course, dimensionality is a very coarse way of understanding, you know, quantum geometry. So we have to go beyond that. So let me tell you briefly how to go beyond this. So the first things we were able to do is not to examine kind of the microscopic structure of the quantum space-time that comes out of these simulations, but global properties. So what we saw is, just a sec, when we look at one of the phases of our model, I mean phases in a kind of in the statistical mechanics sense, we saw that the universe wants to have a specific shape. And the specific shape is plotted here. The shape, by which I mean the three-dimensional volume of the slices, which we've chosen to be three-dimensional spheres. This is just a choice we've made. And if we plot this as a function of this slicing, this discrete proper time, we find what we call a volume profile that, after thinking about it for a few years, we understood can be perfectly matched on the volume profile of a Euclidean de Sitter space in four dimensions, which is a four-dimensional sphere. So this is quite remarkable. So it's a very global way of thinking about geometry, but it is geometry. It's genuine geometry. It goes beyond dimension. So we have a four-dimensional object macroscopically, and macroscopically it seems to have, if you look at this average shape, the spatial volume as a function of property, then it can be very well matched to that of a classical de Sitter space. Okay, so this is kind of a genuine example of emergence, which you haven't put in. You haven't put in any symmetry assumption, as I said. So you had a question?
That was related to the dimensional reduction work.
Yeah.
Could you comment on some results that claimed that CDT is more compatible with 3/2 instead of 2 with high energies?
I would say, well, I would call these preliminary. And we are, well, look, we are also not, we had two, our initial, we weren't at 2, but we had 1.5 with very large error bars. So I would say that leaves room for, I mean, just from the CTC side, for other values, potentially for 3/2. But to what extent it changes the story is a good question. But of course, exactly, you know, if one claims this is universal, one would have to follow the detailed arguments. I mean, we don't have an analytic argument within CDT of what the value should be. So I would say it's within the scope of possibilities. Yeah.
This foliation that you're calculating the bottom,
yes,
of is the one that is put it in from the beginning in
exactly
the simulator.
Exactly. So that then enables us to say, look, a priori, we don't say this is a physical time at all. It's just one of the parameters, right? So that's of course always a good question. Does it mean anything physically? Yeah. What we can conclude from this analysis is that on cosmological scales, it seems to be identifiable with the cosmological proper time. So that is, for instance, that's an invariantly defined time. Say, you know, you have a universe, let's say with some origin, it starts from a point, then cosmological proper time is just, you know, the distance of any point to this initial singularity. So indeed, it has enabled us to say, at least macroscopically, again, on cosmological times, we can seem to be able to identify it with a true proper time. There is no, what it is microscopically, there is no claim of that at all.
And another thing, I'm a bit confused about signatures and the four sphere.
Yes.
Is Euclidean this like?
Yeah. So I'm giving you here the line element. So what I'm saying. So let me spin further the argument I'm making. So we're finding this beautiful de Sitter shape. So the de Sitter shape is what you would get if you, you know, analytically continue a particular way of writing down the sitter in proper time gauge, and then rotating T to IT. Okay, so this is apparently what we see. So one of the questions is, so this is what matches to here, yeah, with a naive standard weak rotation of the of the time variable that appears here. Of course, on rotations this becomes a cosh, right? And this becomes a minus tau squared.
Okay.
So the question is now, so is this a de Sitter space? One is tempted to say, okay, so we've re-derived de Sitter, but well, one has to be really careful because we have just picked out a single mode of the metric, the global volume as a function of time. Okay? So that's not even a local, it doesn't say anything about local geometry. So if we know that locally these things are completely wild. So the question is, can we make harder? What would we have to look at to strengthen the claim that this has something to do with the de Sitter space? Yeah, you had another
question. Back to zero because time is made periodic.
It dynamically wants to be zero, despite the fact that we have given it an S1 cos S3 topology to start with. So yeah, we say you let you be a cylinder, but the dynamics drives us indeed to something where it wants to pinch off to a sphere topology. So that's interesting. It's a dynamical effect. I mean, you could say, look, I've biased myself by choosing a particular topology to start with, but here now, well, the dynamics tells you something else. It wants to be another space, okay, topologically. So yeah, that's, again, it's a tangent, but very interesting. So the question for a long time was, okay, what characterizes a de Sitter space? Well, it's a constant curvature space, right? In the presence of a positive cosmological constant. So can we say anything about the curvature of objects that, morally speaking, locally, they all look like this? Yeah. So how do you even start, you know, defining, like, say, what your Riemann tensor is? And it turns out that the deficit angle idea doesn't really work when you take the continuum limit. It gives you something that just diverges. So that's not good. So that brings us to the story of the quantum Ricci curvature. I try and make it short because I want just to say some results we've obtained with this. So if you don't have a tensorial structure on your metric space, you only know how to measure distances. So we are now talking, I'm now talking Riemannian signature, I'm talking geodesic distances. So no smooth structure, no tangent space structure. How can you define the notion of curvature? Well, there's a beautiful, people in discrete mathematics have thought about this, and inspired by this paper by Jan Olivier, he came up with a notion of what we call quantum Ricci curvature, which is applicable on all of these spaces I've just talked about. So that gives us a way to talk about curvature. What is the idea? Well, if you're on a general metric space with positive, let's say, Ricci curvature, if you draw two spheres of geodesic radius epsilon, whose centers are delta, a geodesic distance delta apart, then please compute the distance of this sphere as a point set to that sphere, basically in whichever way you prefer, and compare this distance, I call this d bar, with delta. Now, it turns out, if I'm sitting on a positively curved space, then this d bar tends to be smaller than delta, and conversely. If you're thinking of, you know, getting some intuition, put yourself on a two-dimensional surface, you know, a saddle point surface or a sphere, to get a little bit of the flavor of why this is true.
And this debar is some sort of average between all the distances between the
Yes, points. Yes, exactly. So they used a Wasserstein distance between these things, a transport distance. We are using a more naive and easier to compute distance where exactly we average over all pairs of points of the two spheres. That's what this is, you know, with the induced weights on the shells. So, and that's work I did together with Niels Klitko, my former PhD student. So very briefly, so that's what we are doing. In order to have just a single scale in this construction, we make the radius of the sphere equal to the distance. Yeah. So then we'll get to a notion which is Ricci curvature pertaining to the coarse grain scale delta, which is extremely useful to have in quantum gravity. So, and what we do is we take this quotient, g bar, the distance between the spheres, divided by delta, this one length scale here, and basically what it becomes is a constant bit and a rest, which we just call the quantum Ricci curvature. So deviations from constancy, this is how you can read this construction, as a function of, you know, me altering the scale, if I wish, give you a measure of curvature. This can be implemented, of course, on a nice Riemannian space. And what you then get is really a proof that this is a sensible idea, if you like. So if you just do, you know, for an arbitrary metric, go on a Riemannian manifold of dimension 2, 3, or 4, you do this calculation, then this you can write, if you like, as a power series in small deltas, and you pick up at this curvature, at the second order correction term, you pick up exactly Ricci curvature. Okay. So the same idea, however, with this prescription does make sense in much, much more general context of curved spaces. And it only involves distance and volume measurements. The directional curve, so, and it's Ricci curve, so it goes beyond scalar. It's not just a scalar quantity, right, which is just, you know, it is generally direction dependent. And if you like, this oriented pair of spheres is kind of the analog of a vector in this context, which is not there because we don't have tensor calculus. Yeah, well defined. So, oops, so it's beautiful. Hi, where am I? Getting ahead of myself. Here we were, sorry. Here we were. Yeah, if you're only interested in scalar curvature, you can let the two spheres fall on top of each other, but still do the same thing, average over all pairs. Yeah, and then Ricci will disappear and you will only get kind of scalar curvature. And the same is true, of course, also for quantum implementations. So this now gives us a highly non-trivial notion of a coarse-grained curvature at scalar delta, at scale delta, and which is interesting because often in quantum gravity, we are interested in scale-dependent information. We want to see how things behave on Planckian scales. Then we want to kind of coarse-grain and say, okay, but what does this translate into on bigger scales? So what we've shown, very in a nutshell, so this is a quantity that can be computed, it's feasible, yeah, it does scale, it's scalable, it does depend on the scale, it's renormalizable, it does stay finite in a continuum, that's important because it comes from an operator that clearly does need renormalization non-perturbatively, and it's robust with respect to anomalous scaling. That comes from the fact that you are, to get it, you're dividing two quantities of the same type, you're dividing two distances. Yeah, the sphere distance with the center distance. So you often get anomalous scaling that volumes, areas, etc., lengths don't scale canonically in this non-perturbative regime. So if this happens, you see, it's likely in that in this quotient, both, you know, the numerator and the denominator will be affected in the same way. So that's what I mean by robust. And on nice classical spaces, it reproduces the standard result. Now, I've been very careful to avoid saying quantum Ricci curvature is an observable because it's not an observable in the same sense as R of X is not an observable because it depends on a point. So to construct an observable, again, we have to average it over space-time. And if you do this, you get what's called a volume profile. Okay? So you sum over all pairs of points in your manifold and, you know, compute this QRC, with the only restriction that they should have a fixed geodesic distance. Okay? So that's then my quantum averaging, and then I extract from this an average curvature that depends on my coarse-graining scale, and this dependence on this coarse-graining scale I call now the profile. And why is that interesting? Well, because it gives a kind of a fingerprint, kind of a curvature fingerprint of an entire universe. And if you do it for a classical space, it comes out in a very characteristic way for constant curvature spaces. It doesn't matter, this is for too deep, it's the same in other dimensions. If I'm on a flat space, I evaluate, you know, this KQ as it comes from this averaging over the entire space, I just get a straight line. So there are no deviations from a constant. But if I have a positively curved space, remember there's this minus here, this is an indication of a positively curved space, Yeah. So this is a profile in the continuum. If I have a hyperbolic space, it just the correction terms have the opposite signs. But of course, also the shape of the curves, you know, is characteristic. So we've studied these things. So you need these classical fingerprints to have something to compare to for your findings in the quantum theory. So what have you been able to do in this way? Well, we've been able to do our toy models in 2D. Yes.
One slide before, for the positive curvature case, why do you have this kind of?
Oh, yeah, very good. So this is the curvature radius one. So what one sees here, one sits on a sphere, on a two-dimensional sphere or higher dimensional sphere. And you know, I had this arrangement of two delta balls from which I extract the curvature. If I make this very large, they start seeing the global properties that I'm sitting on a sphere, which is, of course, you know, has a specific topology. So this is due to the overall topology. So if I go to large deltas, I explore not just local geometric properties, but I start picking up topological information. Uh-huh. So typically, if you're just interested in local geometry, you will be examining this region here. But in principle, more information gets picked up by this fingerprint.
So does this delta around 3 offer any specific?
Yeah, this is pi. This is pi. So it has something to do with, you know, how things wrap and kind of cross the equator on your sphere. Indeed. Yes. So yeah, good question. Thank you. So now I have my wild quantum ensembles. What is their curvature? Okay, let's start with these Lorentzian 2D. This is CDT in two dimensions, describing two-dimensional Lorentzian quantum gravity. Okay. So a typical geometry, this is a Lorentzian universe. It's a spatial universe, which is a single circle whose size oscillates wildly. So on this, we now evaluate our curvature. And now, if we make the volumes, of course, we can only simulate ever for finite volumes. If we make the volumes in the simulations quite small, then we'll pick up exactly the topological effect that this double sphere will start wrapping around the compact direction of the cylinder. And then we see that curves feel this. I mean, they are wrapping, you know, onto each other. It feels topological effects. When we make the lattice larger and larger, when we'll just probe really local curvature properties. And so the largest, my PhD student Jörn Brunekreff has done is 600K. And you see, this is a curve for the QRC. This initial thing, this is just lattice artifact. So one should take this seriously from about here. Now this is a torus. We cyclically identify it. You would say, okay, probably it's flat. It comes out as flat. Well, but it doesn't. You see, flat would mean a straight line, but this is just very gently inclined. And it has to do with the fact that this is actually, there is no classical limit that is a nice torus of two-dimensional quantum gravity. It's all quantum fluctuations. So it's a longer story, but this is how it comes out, maybe surprisingly. Before, this is the Euclidean version of 2D. So this is Liouville gravity. So what is the QRC there? Well, Dilas has measured it, and it can be, so these are the typical universes. So what he's been able to do is to really map that onto continuum results that pertain to a five-dimensional sphere. Okay, so another surprise. But these are pure quantum systems, so you don't know a priori what to expect. Now, let's go back to my original motivation. I wanted to understand whether my de Sitter universe can in any way be called positively constantly curved. Of course, we have only our global observables, the average curvature that we are examining, the Ricci scalar. And indeed, we've measured it for really large volumes of up to more than a million building blocks. And again, the match is not as beautiful as it was in 2D, right? There is a lot more space to cover in four dimensions, but it can be well mapped onto the continuous curve of a continuum sphere beyond this cutoff where we know it's completely dominated by lattice artifacts. So what we see here is it's clearly not constant. It's going down. And the slope, of course, means it's positively curved. And it's reasonably plausible that indeed, if only we could make our lattices even bigger, you know, well, this is good evidence that also the curvature properties in the sense of expectation values are those of a De Sitter space. So that's beautiful, I would say. Okay? So that's what one is able to do. So this is an outlook of other things we are looking at, observables, which get much closer to interesting physical questions you want to ask, for instance, when you say, okay, does this now really give me an interesting description of the very early universe, which may be De Sitter-like, but with huge quantum fluctuations. So one thing you want to understand is, in what sense is this homogeneous and isotropic? Right? There are all these wiggles, and then people say, oh yeah, it's clear. These wiggles, they must kind of average out. Well, it's absolutely not clear. You have to define a measure that measures deviations from homogeneity and isotropy. And we have now, so together with my PhD student, Agustin Silva, we are really defining quantitative measures. And what one is doing basically is one looks at observables averaged over geodesic balls. One can make these geodesic balls very tiny or very large. In either case, one looks at a covering of a space, a quantum space, with these geodesic balls, and you just measure, you look at the statistics of this quantity. And then you check, well, how much are the typical deviations from the mean for the ensemble of these geodesic balls? And of course, you can translate it to the quantum theory and evaluate this type of thing in the sense then as expectation values. So we haven't yet done it for the quantum Ricci curvature, but we've done it for the Hausdorff dimension, or rather Agustin has taken the measurements. And what one sees is that within relatively short, for relatively small ball sizes, one gets to something that looks very homogeneous. So this being going to zero means I have absolute homogeneity. It's just a sketch to give you the flavor of what we're doing. Next, very interesting are curvature-curvature correlators. We have now a notion of curvature, so can we implement it? I mean, this is something that people do compute when they do QFT on curved spaces, although they can't really do it for the gravitation. They can't really do it for the gravitons. So the question is it at all feasible that we can do this? And yes, there's now prototype calculation, which shows, by my student Jesse von der Dahlen, that it is possible. It's computationally accessible. So what one does basically is, well, strictly speaking, one looks at this average sphere distance and correlates it at two different points, point X and point Y. And one uses, because one is not interested in the directional information, one uses this double sphere prescription. And what one then does is one can study, well, how is this cross-grained over this ball correlated to that here, the curvatures. And as you can see here, so this is for two different sizes of these balls. As soon, and the distance of the balls is rescaled by delta. So it turns out that as soon as the spheres don't overlap anymore, the correlations go completely to zero. So what does that mean? Should they, well, there are of course no local degrees of freedom in two dimensions. So it's what one expects, but it also shows, at least in 2D, it's computationally quite feasible. And of course, that's exactly the same thing we want to do in higher D. Okay, getting my last slide. So to summarize, so general progress has been made in applying non-perturbative methods, like I explained them to you today from CDG, to full four-dimensional quantum gravity. And we can now compute observables and compare them. And one prime area of comparing them is with what comes out of functional renormalization group methods, people working on asymptotic safety. And I really want to especially mention Frank Sauer and his group at Radboud, who've been with whom we've kind of compared in a very fruitful way. And it is possible. So I think that's a whole new perspective on quantum gravity, right? I have an observable, you can compute it, I can compute it, let's compare notes. So I think that's a very good direction to go. The art is two. I gave you a whole number of things we are investigating, but to find more observables that can be reliably measured, say on the lattice, say with other non-perturbative, with your preferred non-perturbative methods, and of course, ultimately related to macroscopic physics. So what we've seen here is CDT. I have, of course, focused on that. That's my area of research. You have a beautiful example of space-time emergence, this de Sitter space, but also this new tool, this quantum Ricci curvature. I gave you some glimpses that this can be really used in many creative ways of investigating interesting properties that help us to nail down what we mean by this quantum universe, and hopefully, again, related to early universe physics. There are many other ongoing projects I haven't been able to talk about. You can ask me if you still have energy. So renormalization group flow analysis, role of matter, very interesting, role of global topology, quantum cosmology entailed by CDT, something that Jan has been working on recently, early universe structure for radiation, you have it. Here are two CDT reviews, and this ends my story. So thank you so much for holding out.
First, a question by student. That would be a great question during the talk.
I have one. Yeah, it wasn't very clear to me what's happening at the Planck scale.
Yes.
From this perspective.
Yes.
You mentioned the dimensional reduction, but mainly can you elaborate?
Well, at the Planck scale, really, so when I said, you know, we generate a quantum space time, so that's really what I have in mind, is that is kind of the ground state of this dynamical system we are simulating, which is really the dynamics of this path integral. So that's something, you know, this kind of, you know, the state of lowest effective action or whatever you want to call it. And we understand that it's a very non-classical object. So what we do, but we have to try and understand what it is. And the point is, you have to ask questions. So you have to ask, so it's really, that's the lab idea. So there is this thing, and now, you know, you want to understand, anyway, in what category should I describe this thing? You know, when we started thinking about curvature, it's not clear that a meaningful notion of curvature exists in this regime at all. You know, it could be, and of course, totally counterintuitive things happen, like this reduction in the dimension. That's, of course, not a property any classical space can have, so it does give you some information saying, look, this is clearly not a nice, smooth manifold, because I have this scale dependent dimensional reduction. So we are, with every new observable, we are getting, you know, teasing out new information about what are the physical properties of this object and how should we think about it.
More students?
I have a question, but it's about the de Sitter sphere, which you get after doing an Euclidean simulation.
Right.
And it's an Euclidean sphere.
Yes.
And so you write it and these coordinates, if you would recrotate time, you would get a Lorentzian de Sitter space, I guess.
Well, I would say it's a suggestive way of doing the reverse recrotation. Yes.
But if I imagine I do the recrotation like locally by, you know, changing your by using your slicing, then I don't seem to get Lorentzian visitor space because it would be non-compact.
Is it local, doing it locally?
You have your slices, and you have your simplices of a given type, and so you can assign them all again a Lorentzian geometry, and you get a Lorentzian geometry.
Yes.
But if I kind of imagine that naively, I didn't do the exercise, it doesn't seem to give me a Lorentzian de Sitter space already for the reason that Lorentzian de Sitter space would look like a Cauchy, so it would be non-compact in one direction.
Yeah, it would give a non-compact thing, but that's the nature, that's right.
No, I'm kind of,
but of course it wouldn't, not in a finite time interval, it wouldn't become infinite big in a finite time interval.
There seems to be a tension about just doing the recrotating the time coordinate in your mm-hmm. presentation and is doing the more local version of the quotation, which you can...
Well, but I'm not claiming...
Your slicing.
Well, you see, I mean, the only other example where we have, of course, explicit analytical control, as you know, is in 1 plus 1. Uh-huh. And we start, of course, with this alpha prescription. And then we have this beautiful, derives this beautiful loop-loop correlator analytically. And there, really, there is an overall global time there. If we rotate this to IT, we get a beautiful propagator with all, you know, all properties that a Lorentzian propagator should satisfy. So I would say this is very suggestive at a global level here for this particular shape variable. I mean, it's suggestive, but, you know, it's the same time. I mean, really, it does, of course, refer to this slice in some way. So I've used this to make this analytic continuation. I just think of, I can think of it as a mathematical trick, right? And now, of course, after taking the continuum limit, it doesn't tell me precisely what to do, but I would say the outcome is very suggestive, that at least for globally, there is a way to rotate it. I'm not saying this is the only way, but this leads to a nice physical interpretation, right? And it was never more than an analytic continuation in the first place, or something I call a time variable. But I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Well, maybe I can try to answer it. I mean, I think it makes not very much sense to think about an individual configuration and its analytical continuation. Because when we claim, for instance, that we see this theta space, it's an average of many measurements in the past interval. Now, if you make the rotation, then of course, first of all, I mean, the weight will be completely different. And this means that the average sum might be very different, and it might, in fact, be an expanding thing. And this is, of course, known from modern quantum field theory, that what is analytically continued is not the individual configurations. It doesn't make any sense. In general, I mean, they're not even analytic in time, a generic configuration, but the sum of all these have an analytic configuration. I mean, the propagator has an analytic configuration. But the problem is the sum of all paths, but you are not rotating the rotation of the individual paths doesn't have much meaning.
So you would say it wouldn't make sense if I try to even define, for instance, a curvature in a Lorentzian context, apply it to each configuration, and then compute the average.
Well, I would say
based in the Monte Carlo.
No, can I answer that? That's a different thing. Well, you can try this. I mean, I don't think that it's worthwhile trying. Number one, it's very non-trivial to find a Lorentzian implementation. Right?
Yeah. Okay.
And then you can ask yourself, does it lead to other results or different results? I think these are in principle good questions. So this is not, there's no uniqueness claim. There's also, of course, no uniqueness claim behind the analytic continuation views, but I would say is some common sense that enters in the construction. And it's clear, depending on the physical questions you're asking, that any statement about how does this properly rotate back to Lorentzian signature and how to interpret it, as we know, is very, very tricky. And anything that's time dependent.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, no. And most of these things are just not well understood. So I'm confining myself to making statements about, you know, like the global proper time that I have some understanding about. But there are very many, especially when it comes then also to matter coupling, this is not really well understood how this intertwines with Wick rotating. Yeah. So that's a long story in itself. I don't think anyone understands it, but also, so we don't understand it, although we have thought a lot about it already. Yeah.
Mark has a question.
Yes. So, on this slide, since you mentioned comparison to FRG methods, so
right.
Typically, if one uses FRG, one finds that a curvature squared or Arminu squared becomes relevant. And this doesn't seem to be the case in CDT, so.
I'm not making this statement at all. As I'm saying, I have curvature squared terms clearly in here that are, you know,
But wouldn't you need to add them to your bad action in order to find a transition if they really became relevant?
I think it's very difficult to one-on-one, you know, compare elements of the formalism. I mean, rephrase your question in terms of an observable, and then we can talk again.
Wouldn't the number of relevant directions, I mean, the number of experiments that I have to perform to fix, like, to then predict everything, like everything else, and every higher order curvature operators, wouldn't this be also an observable?
In a very indirect way, I don't know. Of course, you know, in your formalism, of course, you know, well, whatever, the k to zero limit. I mean, it's kind of complicated. What is and isn't an observable? I would say, a priori, I mean, values of renormalized couplings, they are not a priori observables, obviously, but only things that depend on them in a certain way. So that's why I'm saying one should then, any such question, one should try and rephrase, you know, in terms of an observable that does make sense and is morphism invariant and everything. I don't. Maybe there are such candidates. I mean, yeah, I'd be happy to talk about it.
But in general, I would say, I mean, in the Wilsonian sense, this is how we are thinking about it. And I guess in a certain way, this is also how you're thinking about it. I mean, a given quantum field theory is characterized by a fixed point.
Yes.
And whatever expectation values depends on how you approach this fixed point. What we are looking for is to find, to show that there is such a fixed point. And after that, you can start to define in more detail how to approach it and what observables that you want to say. But the existence of this fixed point is a crucial thing. And whether it can be found just by using this simple action that we have or not depends on, well, we have to look at it. I mean, suppose it would have a general spin system. Then you only have to tune the temperature to get a fixed point. This is just one variable that you have to tune. And we know that there's a universal quantum field theory associated with this fixed point. The details of math and so on depends on how you approach it. Or, I mean, you don't even have to approach it, you just have to go to the critical surface in a specific way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same. But if you don't find anything interesting, if you don't say, OK, we have no fixed point, then you might have to add higher dimension terms.
So are you saying that the fixed point that you find might have more relevant directions than two?
Yeah,
okay. Even though you start with Einstein,
But in the phase space we are currently having, I mean, the second order line, well, presumably they just require one additional fine tuning, but they might also. You know, you might have to go along the lines.
Okay, but
you cannot look in such detail.
To FRG studies, where one would say one needs the critical hypersurface is higher dimension.
Again, I'm not sure I can translate these in the structure.
But you're also finding a fixed point just by truncating it.
Yes.
Okay. So if you can say something, I feel we can maybe also say something.
Uh-huh.
So this is a shadow of the real theory, of course, that you see by just making this truncation.
Yes.
And here, it would be a real fixed point, and all the higher derivatives would be buried in kind of what we see as kind of discretization effects, but these are kind of higher derivative terms, which play a more important role than we maybe think just by putting in the
Okay.
I'm sorry, George, but I just want to finish on a question by Lee that I asked a couple of time ago on the chat, and after we'll stop the session, but I think we can continue to discuss later. So Lee asking that, I mean, Lee, maybe you want to ask your question yourself, but...
Yes,
we
heard.
Right.
Good, very good. I just wanted a comment and a question. The comment is that it seems that we're not very far away. Well, the first comment is congratulations. It's great work. The second comment is that you're doing something very similar to what I'm doing, which is measuring something locally at two sites and averaging over the pairs of the sites. And I think that's very interesting, and we should discuss more. The last thing was just about causality. When you say you can extract the propagator, the correct propagator, you know that it has the analogous of the Feynman propagator as the causality is expressed.
What was the question?
Is causality expressed in the same way that it is in the Feynman propagator?
Yes. I mean, it's unitary, of course. We are claiming we have a unitary passage. It's unitary with respect to a choice of a parameter which has, you know, features over time. So T is not integrated over, if you like. If that is the question.
Yes, okay, thanks.
The Feynman propagator is, of course, not the causal propagator. What we are discussing is a causal propagator. I mean, when we discuss the propagation of the universe, I mean, from the very beginning and calculate the propagating universe from one size to another size, it's a causal propagation. It's not the Feynman propagation, because that's not causal. I mean, this is the sum of this is a specific sum of the causal propagator and the anti-causal propagator, as you know, and it doesn't stay within the causal cone, I mean, the Feynman propagator. So it's not
right.
It's not the Feynman propagator that we are counting.
Okay, this needs more discussion, but that's very good. Thank you.
I think we're way over time, so let's stop it.
Thank you.